Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Monday. Happy post-Thanksgiving rebooting the news. Dave Weiner here. Jay Rosen.
I'm here. Hi, everybody. Hi, Dave.
I just said hi on behalf of everybody.
Yeah.
Hope they don't mind.
We got tons of topics to talk about today.
Totally, tons of topics.
And I want to get right into the middle because I know people are eager to hear what we have to say.
I hope
so,
they are. Yeah.
Number one on your list, I have a list too, is a programmable Twitter client. And I know you've been talking about this a little bit on Twitter, and it's something that I think bears on other discussions we've had. So explain to me what that means.
It does bear on other discussions. First I wrote this one up on Tumblr, starting to branch out, and, you know, remember the content tools I talked about? Well, they're starting to get mature, and so now I can have my choice. I can do it on WordPress or Tumblr or Postgres, which is really cool. And also last week we got a whole bunch of connections going between all three of those products, including some new features from one of them which were necessary from Postgres. So it's like things are starting to come together nicely. I'm kind of happy about that. Anyway, the programmable client, you know, there's been this sort of like, I think, stagnation going on in the Twitter space. And it's reflected in conversations I have periodically with Robert Scovel, who's a friend of mine and a famous blogger. And lately, for like the last couple of years, they've been all about Twitter. And lately, they've been ending with, well, of course they'll never do it. It sort of got to be a joke, you know. Like we figure out, well, this is what needs to happen, and then of course they'll never do it. And of course the they in that is Twitter Corporation. So the question always has been is, well, how do we get out of this sort of quagmire where we're waiting and waiting and waiting for these guys to like open this gate so we can start having fun again? And I think that this week something snapped for me. I finally gave up on the client guys ever doing it. Just been hearing in the back channel over and over again that they're too scared of Twitter, the company, and they're never going to do anything that they don't like or that they find, you know, freaky or scary or whatever. And so then that led me to the idea that maybe it'll happen at the next level out, and what we really need is a Twitter client that can be programmed by end users. And that may sound like a bad idea. This is a debate that we always get into. Can users program? You know, it's almost by definition, you know, of course users can't program because that's what it means to be a user, right? Users don't program.
Right.
But the truth is that actually there is sort of a gray area in which power users do program. And there's a long tradition in, you know, software going back to, in my experience, with Unix. In the early days, Unix had a shell language, and it was programming language, sort of very lightweight one, and you could get some things, serious things done with the shell language, and that meant that Unix was a very customizable operating system. It also meant that the users that it attracted tended to be the kind of people who liked to do that. Then, you know, MS-DOS came along, and it had a batch language, and the reason why Lotus 1-2-3, a lot of people think the reason why Lotus 1-2-3 was so popular was that it had a macro language, and in fact, huge numbers of people, you know, accountants and business-type people did program Lotus 1-2-3. What they did was they took the things that they did frequently and taught Lotus how to do them, you know, once, and then they could just do them just by hitting a keystroke, and they would do these very elaborate things. And in fact, when I was part of Symantec, we even started a division to market these macros because some of these end users actually did so much with the macros that they became products.
I'd love to teach Twitter to do things that I wanted it to.
There you go, exactly. And that's the impulse of a programmable Twitter client is that users get so, the habits get so ingrained that you know exactly what features you would like. However, they may be so particular to you that no developer is ever going to do them because, you know, how would they know to do the one thing that Jay Rosen needs to do that the particular to your life because you have a child who is a musician, or you have a child who, or your family likes to go on vacations to some weird place in, I don't know, Europe or something. You know what I'm saying? It's like they wouldn't know to do it, and there wouldn't be a sizable enough market to do it, and that's the reason why you have these things. And it also is very compatible with this idea that you hear a lot about Twitter, that it's the users that are actually designing the thing and that the
right.
platform vendor. So we had this, you know, I was very active in this area in the late 80s, early 90s, mid-90s, and I was working on end user scripting for the Macintosh, and we had this sort of little snotty slogan that went like this. It says, well, we learned to let the users design the product, so then we decided to go ahead and let them implement it, too. And that's the idea, is that now the users aren't going to be scared of the company, of Twitter the company. They won't understand the politics. There's nothing at stake for them. They'll do whatever they want to do, you know?
So what is the programmable Twitter client, then?
Pardon me?
So what is a programmable Twitter client?
It's simply a client that has a programming language built into it. And you type in, instead of typing commands, in addition to typing commands or using mouse strokes, you type little programs into it. And then you say, run the program, and it does the things that you would have done.
So it's an application built on top of Twitter, compatible with Twitter, that I could use to make Twitter do certain idiosyncratic things that I wanted to do for me, correct?
Right. Correct. That's correct. Idiosyncratic things that Jay Rosen personally wants it to do. And I'm not trying to be silly. I'm being very, that's very straight. Now, the funny thing about it is that eventually once you get in the habit of doing this, you're probably going to come across something that another user wanted to do. Or you're going to be listening to some other user, like somebody in one of your classes or a colleague of yours at NYU, and they're going to say, boy, I wish Twitter would just do this. They say, oh, I know how to do that. And you write a little macro for them. And that's the kind of culture that develops around these user scripting environments.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, the theory is a lot of people will say, well, you know, most users don't need that. And in a way, that's true. Until the killer feature that you need is only available in that environment. At which point, yeah, you need it. And so it struck me that Twitter is so ripe for this. And why haven't we? It's because we've gotten out of the habit of doing this. So at some point, you know, security issues, you know, that we used to think in these terms that, of course, once a market gets to a certain point, you want to have one of these, you want to have a programmable thing around. And it's a way to, and the other thing is that you just realize that, you know, in a sense, the developers of the clients are as much in the way of progress as Twitter the company is. And this may be the way to blow the whole thing open. I mean, I so desperately want to blow this thing open, you know, so that we can have a market here.
Mm-hmm.
This is the latest incarnation of Dave's pipe dream.
Very interesting. Well, it kind of bears on something that wrote about this week on my own use of Twitter, which is that I discovered how I wanted to use the retweet function of Twitter, which I don't particularly care for, and I hadn't used it at all after it was introduced into my system. But I discovered a use for it that I feel I do have, which is when I just want to pass something along somebody said to me and kind of indicate a raised eyebrow but make no comment whatsoever. Like, I couldn't even add to this. You know, I'm just passing it along. I have nothing to say about it, but my eyebrow is raised. That's what I'm going to use the retweet function for and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And when I said this on my feed, a bunch of people wrote back to me and said, well, if you're the only one, no, it'll never get communicated, or nobody will understand what you mean, you know? It won't get clear, it won't get through to people what you're doing. And I just said, well, I don't care. You know, I'll take my chances. I'm just going to use it this way, and that's my way of doing it. And I'm not really bothered by this objection. But if there was some way that I could indicate that this is what I'm doing, if there's some way, you see what I mean? If there's some way I could program it so that this is my raised eyebrow retweet, I would do it.
Well, but you said you're doing it. You're not.
I am doing it.
Yeah. So you communicated that perfectly perfectly well, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I read that, and I read your comment, and I loved it. And you know what I did? I retweeted it. And you know, unlike a lot of people that who don't like the new retweet, I love it. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, I know. You seem to like it, but
I really like it.
What I'm saying is that what I am establishing is my policy is that there's the action and there's the rule that governs this action.
But Jay, I don't.
And
think
I can take the action, but I can't communicate the rule.
But you don't need to communicate the rule. That rule is communicated because we all understand how retweet works. Okay. In other words, we all understand it wasn't that you chose not to put a comment on it; it was that you couldn't put a comment on it. So for all we know, you might have something to say about it, but who cares? I mean, the point is, the thing I love about the way retweet works is that it does force that silence on you. You have to STFU, you know, and just let the other person speak. Because, you know, I mean, that's the thing. I love it because it absolves me of the feeling that I have to say something.
Uh-huh.
That I can
all
just
right.
look at something, and then there's the poetry that goes with that. It's like, because it opens up in the other person's mind all the horrible questions that all these people had for you, you know, all this angst comes flowing out. It's art, Jay. I mean, that's the whole point of art, right? I mean, if everybody had the same, if it were perfectly obvious what the artist meant when he or she did what she did, he or she did, then it wouldn't be art. The whole process of the art is the fact that it evokes a response from the person who's observing.
Mm.
So this retweet, this form of retweet, is the artist's retweet. It says, basically, you figure out what I meant by it. I don't know, you know.
Uh-huh.
I love it. I love it. You know, the other reason I love it, Jay, is because
it's
so
damn
easy. It's so easy. Oh, because
it is
you
easy.
Hate it? Oh, give me a break. I love you, Jay. I mean, the fact that it causes you pain hurts me. I feel your pain.
No, I hate this function, but I like that you like it. Life is full of differences like this.
Yeah, it is beautiful, actually, that we both have such opposite reactions. But I was saying, I just want to get this out there, the reason I like it is it's so easy.
Yes, it is easy.
Think about it. I was not a retweeter before at all, because retweeting is a laborious process, and it revolves, you know, figuring out which letters I can remove from this other person's thing to make room for my thing, you know, and I didn't like it as somebody who got retweeted because basically I don't like being edited. I hate being edited. I never gave them the permission to do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think disrupting retweeting is one of the nicest things the Twitter guys ever did.
All right.
And that's going to get me some hate mail, I hope.
All right. Well, let's move on.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Content. Jay, you don't like the word content now.
No. You know, it must have been years ago, maybe 2 years ago or 3 years ago, Doc Searles, who's a mutual friend of ours and who has been on this show, wrote a couple of posts about this word content, which began to arise in discussions of the web as a kind of a catch-all category for the stuff that people make and put on the web. And he warned his readers, including me, that you're going to regret it, you know, using this word. This is not a good way of talking about what we do, because as soon as you allow that kind of category to describe both, you know, junk and carefully constructed material, you're kind of transforming your work into almost like cargo. Like everything is cargo, and it doesn't matter if it's got a precious machine in it or it's got, you know, newspaper clippings. And he says, you're going to regret it, I'm telling you. And I said, oh, Doc, I think you're making a bit too too much of this. It's just a term of convenience to mean, you know, different kinds of stuff that people put on the web. That was my attitude. But now I'm starting to see what he meant, because a couple of weeks ago, a Wired writer emailed me, and he said, I have this piece coming out about a company called Demand Media, and I just think it's up your alley, and I want you to know it's going to be out in a couple of days. So it was a heads up. And this writer really had my number, because when this piece came out on this company called Demand Media, I was totally fascinated by it, but also, in a way, appalled. And here's why. This company, which does $200 million worth of business and is currently valued at about $1 billion, works as follows. It has this algorithm that's basically tapping into the live web, into search, but lots of other things as well, and spitting out a bunch of keywords that represent what people are searching on, looking for, clicking on, interested in right now, based on all the huge volume of data that's created just by people using the web. Then they have this other algorithm that tells them what advertisers are willing to pay to advertise next to pages with these keywords on them. Then they take a third algorithm that helps them transform these bits of keywords into actual sentences and headlines that become instructions for what they call the creators of, and here's where Doc's warning comes in, content. Then they take those instructions and they put them into an online closed system where you can log in if you're a content creator and get assignments to produce articles with the titles that they already know the advertisers will pay a certain amount of money against in keyword advertising. And through this method of generating keywords from the live web, matching it to the available amount of revenue for those keywords, and then commissioning people to produce really cheap videos and blog posts and how-tos and guides that have these keywords in them, and estimating how much money that piece of content will earn over its lifetime, and then paying people these rock-bottom prices like $15 an article, $20 a video, to produce these things without caring at all if they're any good, if they actually work, without having any quality demands whatsoever. They're able to actually perform way better than any old-fashioned system in which editors kind of dream up topics and assign them to writers. So I read about this company, and I recognized right away that they were doing something with the live web that could be an important part of the rebooted system of news, but not at all the way that they were using it, because they're almost developing what's in effect a new kind of spam business.
What kind of business?
Spam business, but instead of spamming your inbox, they're spamming the web itself, right?
Yeah. Well, it seems like a pointless exercise, right? I mean, because the people who are writing the content are sort of very similar to the people who are driving the keywords and are the ones who are tweeting about the... In other words, it hardly seems significant what's going on.
Well, it is not significant from a journalistic or editorial point of view, except in this sense. I think part of the rebooted system of news would be to build a tool for editors and journalists that would give us really good information people are interested in now, and to take that information and not match available ad revenues to rock bottom content production prices, which is this crazy business that demand media is in, but instead take really good information coming from the live web and begin to produce high quality work into that demand. Because what the Wired article said that really caught my interest was that we've done all this work and we've really revolutionized through the internet and the tools of the web, the supply part of media. But we haven't done that much on the demand side. And in traditional newsrooms, there's always been this very familiar and by now exhausted debate between should we give people what they're interested in or should we give them what they need to know, you know? And the people who kind of represent the business side of the operation say, well, we have to meet what people are interested in. And then the people who supposedly are protecting the editorial integrity of the newsroom say, no, we have to tell them what they need to know, right? And actually, I don't think either one of those things describes what a healthy rebooted system of news would be like. But I do think that if people interested in serious journalism and high-quality editorial work don't learn to use some of these tools telling them about where demand is, that they're going to miss out on an opportunity. So I don't know what that future system looks like. I know it's not what demand media is doing, but I also know it doesn't lie in ignoring that either. So it's just been a puzzle that I'm trying to work through in my head. I'm trying to see where the openings are for something much more progressive and high quality than what they're doing. So I thought I'd sort of mention here on this show, see what you think.
No, I'm glad you did. These are important things to talk about. I mean,
yeah, really.
Because a lot of times, you know, people call us the utopians, right? I mean, that's what Andrew Keen, I think he put both of us on a list as people, you know, this is what the cynics call us. And,
he did? I didn't see that.
Well, he put me on it. I'm not sure he put you on it. But and there's something very irritating about being put on a list like that. But there is also a point to it. Because, you know, in the early days of a revolution, you only see the good stuff that's going to come from it. I mean, if you're
right.
A guy like me, it's like you go, oh, things are going to be wonderful. Finally, you know, the human species is going to evolve and we're going to be great, blah, blah, blah. And then reality comes around and you find out that, well, actually it has the promise, but you forgot the human beings don't change. And so you have to bring in all of human nature into these things and it's all going to play in this space. And,
right.
You know, I've been talking with Doc all along and we certainly, you know, we were talking at this point and there was another way of looking at this that I think you might find more optimistic, that this demand media thing may just be a transition, because you have to ask when you look at something like this, what comes next, right?
I don't necessarily see it as a stable model. They're just exploiting
right,
what happens.
It's a fluid situation. I mean,
yeah, it's a fluid
and
situation.
So, right, so what is the actual end result of all this? And you see, when I did this little exercise in 2006 timeframe, that what I came up with was this, that eventually advertising is going to go away. And my reasoning was as follows, that advertising, you know, how are they doing this? So I was, you know, involved in a legal matter at the time, and a lot of emails going back and forth between me and the lawyers and the accountants and so forth. And Google was throwing up a lot of ads on these emails, and I was, you know, at one point just was looking to see what kind of ads are they showing me on these things, and you know, how irrelevant are they to what I'm doing, you know? And they were totally irrelevant. I mean, they were trying to sell me new accountants and new lawyers, you know. Mm-hmm. I go, well, that's silly because I'm communicating with my accountant and my lawyer. Why would that be the thing that they would come up with? And that led me to the question of, well, what is an ad anyway? Because ads are changing. Ads are not the same thing that they used to be. And in a way, an ad is a query. An ad is the result of a query. And they try to guess as to what it is I'm interested in, because, and the better they guess, the more it becomes information. The less intrusive
right.
it is, the more wanted it is. It's not an ad anymore. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that Dick Costolo said. He was a very good presenter, by the way. I was really surprised. I never heard him talk. He was speaking at a TechCrunch conference last week.
Wait, explain who he is. Explain who he is.
Oh, I'm sorry. He's the COO of Twitter, the new COO, and he was the CEO of FeedBurner. And I actually don't think I've ever met him. So he was talking about, well, what's coming with Twitter? He says it's going to be advertising, and you're going to love it. Advertising
uh-huh.
you love. And I go, advertising I love? That can't possibly be advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole nature of advertising, as I understand it, is that it's intrusive, that it interrupts you. And or that's viewed from the point of view of the reader, from the point of view of the author or the content owner, what it is an attractor. In other words, I've got my message that I want to communicate, and I've decided that it's a good idea for me to let somebody else hitchhike on that so
mm-hmm.
that they can put their message alongside mine, which is something I've never been willing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, it's far more important that my message gets through without any confusion whatsoever.
Right.
You know, and the money they offer me at best is $5,000 to $10,000 a year, and frankly, you know, that's not very much money. And
right.
So the better.
So if the advertising is going to eventually go away, then the demand media model is simply a transitional stage.
Absolutely, and it is for sure a transitional stage. If I were on their board of directors, you know, I'd be asking them, well, please make sure you know what's coming next, because this can't exist very long. It's not equilibrium.
Yeah.
It's not stable, you know. Which I want to transition to something else very briefly. I saw
I said okay.
Did you? Oh, okay. I didn't hear what you said. It was a Frontline piece that I saw last week with Lowell Burton. And it was very, very good. And it was of the nature of, I forget what you call them, the background pieces, the sort of,
yeah, the backstory.
The backstory. I think we need a better name for that, by the way, so it's more memorable. And what he was covering was credit cards and debit cards. And
mm-hmm.
It was a one-hour piece, and it was all information for people like, you know, you and me, people who own credit cards, use credit cards and debit cards, explaining to us how rigged the system is against us.
Right.
And it was a real eye-opener. And since I use debit cards and always pay my bill in full on credit cards, I couldn't imagine how I ever get got. And I do.
Totally.
Yeah. You can end up buying a $35 cup of coffee. That was sort of the prototype of it. And these guys are real, I mean, they're really bad people, these bankers people. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they do some really harmful things to their customers. And the problem is that nobody knows that they're doing it. And so Bergman and PBS and Frontline did their part to get the information out there. But very few people saw it. And it isn't going to affect, you know, the banks don't have to worry about things like this ever being broadcast.
Okay.
Here's my
comment on that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, two things. When you say very few people saw it, that's why we have to match demand for what people do think they want to know with the supply of
right.
truly serious explanatory journalism, right?
That's why I mentioned this. Exactly right. Yeah, that's why I mentioned it.
That's where we want to go. And this is truly,
you know, we tend to poo-poo this idea that, you know, take your vitamins, you need to know this information. Even if you're not looking for it, you need to know this, right? But it's not. It's true. There is information you need to know.
Totally.
And you may not be looking for it.
No, what I want to erode is the notion that these things are opposed to one another. That
right, right.
That measuring demand and interest and using metadata and delivering on the promise of explaining things that people don't know and don't know they need to know. We need to bring those things together. They are not like opposite worlds, and the promoters of them are not in opposite corners of some boxing ring. We need
right.
to bring
there's
them
another,
together.
there's another place to take this, okay? I want to go in another direction, is that how can we get PBS to get off their asses and start really promoting this stuff? I mean, they are so, I mean, because there's another event that happened this week that I think absolutely we have to talk about, which is that the most popular BitTorrent search site, MiniNova, was decided to shut down this week and on Thanksgiving Day. And should I explain what MiniNova is?
Yeah, I know what BitTorrent is, and I vaguely know what these sites do, but you better explain it.
Okay. Well, MiniNova is like a search engine, like Google. And
right.
What happens, except they take submissions, and people upload stuff, and some of it is infringing, and some of it is non-infringing. And by infringing, I mean sometimes they upload things that they don't have copyright, they don't have the right to upload, and sometimes they upload things that they do have the copyright to upload. They do have the right to upload. And so they provide a service that, you know, their argument has always been is, well, there's nothing, we're not distributing any content here. And therefore, what we're doing is, you know, is completely innocuous.
Right.
And they have a point, because Google does index all the content that MiniNova has. You could find everything on Google that you would have found in MiniNova. The second thing in their favor was that they were in the Netherlands, and the Netherlands has very liberal laws. And so they were able to stay on the air for a very, very long time. They eventually got sued by the Dutch equivalent of the RIAA, and they had a judgment against them, and then they, you know, appealed it, and then they finally decided on Thanksgiving Day to shut it down. And then I thought about, well, what is the... There's such an opportunity here for... Here's Lowell Bergman producing this wonderful thing, okay, that everybody needs to know about. And what's stopping PBS from saying, okay, all of our content is now non-infringing. You can now put all of our content on BitTorrent. And,
yeah.
And of course, it all is on BitTorrent anyway.
Right.
And you can put our content on BitTorrent, which means here's this vacuum. You've got all these people going to MiniNova going, well, what's new? And there's nothing there. You know, the site's still there. It's just they just took off all the stuff they could not verify copyright ownership of. And that means it's almost nothing. And why not fill that vacuum?
There's
and
nothing
I
to stop PBS to been doing it except for a lack of vision and lack of courage and insight and just general lethargy, you know?
Yeah.
I was thinking about this week because NewsHour, the PBS NewsHour, which is their main news program, decided it needed to overhaul itself. And overhauling means like format changes and two hosts instead of one and emphasizing the web more and bringing the web producers who had been like in another building, you know, into the newsroom. But the real overhaul that NewsHour needs has to do with courage and vision. I mean, they see the world as existing between the 40-yard lines, you know, like everything is either to the right of Mark Shields or to the left of David Gergen, David Brooks, yeah. And
yeah.
The world doesn't necessarily all fit between those two tracks, you know. And I've just been disgusted with PBS because they are supposed to be the public alternative to the commercial system. And really what they are is simply a quieter and less confrontational version of the commercial news system. And that's not enough. They need to break out. They need to do some things that are radical. And maybe
they're capable of it,
but I haven't seen it so far.
NPR did it, you know.
NPR is on the way, yeah.
NPR played the role that the New York Times played in RSS. They played in broadcasting. It was building. We had done, you know, there was a small explosion of new programming coming out in podcasting in late 2004. And had NPR not done what they did, it's quite possible podcasting might have declined right then. It might have just, you know, fizzled out.
Right.
But Tony Khan at WGBH said, nope, this is too good to pass on. And he started doing his show, and he was on the NewsHour, not NewsHour, BBC has a program that they do with WGBH radio news show. And then that started being podcast, and then, you know, I don't know, he's a very influential guy at NPR, and they all started doing it. So it may be that there's just one person at PBS who right now, because this is the moment of opportunity, Jay, right now, this instant, this is exactly like the moment when the when the music industry decided to kill Napster.
Right.
And lost control of music distribution at that
right.
point. Had they decided instead to say that, okay, this is what our users want, right? The PBS conclusion would be a little bit different. It would be, okay, we know that people aren't, like, hungering for Lowell Bergman's reports, but now there's no competition. The competition just went away.
That's right. They should also say that we are going to go all in on the open systems. We are public broadcasting, and we are completely committed to the open way as the commercial news system starts to consider all these barriers and gates and closed options that we see Murdoch and company wrestling with every day, right? And they should go in the completely opposite direction and say, we are part of the open system of news, and that is going to be our strategic direction in the future.
And we're going to define it, too. In other words,
we're going to define it, and we're going to figure out how to fund quality work within it and how to distribute through open sharing networks and everything else. That's what they should
Because they let the entertainment industry position it. They're the only ones with a voice on this subject, and of course they don't like it. Because
right.
it means them giving up control. But the beauty of it and the example of NPR was that's exactly how they kicked commercial radio's butt. Because they couldn't move it. They couldn't move in this direction. They
had
too many. And, of course, NPR had legal issues as well. I mean, it wasn't a clear-cut thing for them because they had the deals with the terrestrial stations, you know.
Well, they still have that problem. That's still a big problem for them.
I know, but they decided to just shrug their shoulders and go ahead and do it anyway.
Yeah. No, NPR is way ahead of PBS on this score, way ahead.
Right. If there's anybody out there listening that has any influence with these PBS guys, I just got to say, now is the time to do it. I'll help any way I can, you know. It's one of these things where let's not let this opportunity pass without noticing it. It's just okay.
Amen.
Yeah.
I want to go back to something you said about this documentary on Frontline. I think in that example we have something really important for the rebooted system of news, which is that everybody knows about their own credit cards. They know what their credit cards are. They use them. They are familiar everyday objects that are actually important to people. But the system that lies behind those credit cards and debit cards is very opaque to us. We don't know much about it at all.
Right.
It's very complicated, right?
It opens it all up. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that is where professional journalists need to apply themselves. It's in between these simple objects that do have our attention and the very complicated systems that lie behind them. You see? And it's through building that connection between the simple facts of our lives and the complex systems that we can't see and understand because they're opaque.
But they are so
that
invisible.
Is where we need professional journalists to do their work.
Yes, and this is a perfect example because the question Bergman asked was, you ever wonder why with the Fed dropping interest rates down to zero, your APR on your credit card is 28%.
Yeah.
Ever wonder about that? How did that happen?
Exactly.
I can't imagine anybody doesn't wonder about that. You know, it's like, what a gotcha. How did they manage to pull that out in a free market?
So here's my idea for exactly. This is my idea for a new news site: is you come to the site and there's a box like the Twitter box at the top, and it says, "Journalists are standing by. What is your question?"
Wow, that's beautiful.
And you type your question in that requires journalists to answer, and either not immediately, maybe the next day, maybe the next week, maybe the next month, the questions that really count get answered.
Well, here's the problem with that. You got to wipe the smile off their face. They think they're referees, Jay. You know, that was one of the things in your whole business about, what's that guy's name at MSNBC?
Chuck Todd, yeah.
Yeah, Chuck Todd, who I used to admire. I totally
Me too.
Chuck Todd. What a great guy, you know. I mean,
he's
during
dropped.
The election, he turned
he's
into a
dropped in my estimation.
Bully. Hey, he thinks he's a referee.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Now, how could a referee, first of all, he's not a referee. He's a press person. And they have press people in sports, too, and they have referees. And we don't have referees. Well, if we have them, they're called judges. You know, and they are not referees, and that is disgusting. That guy thinks he's a referee. But you know what? Nobody is going to be standing by waiting for your questions and then eagerly going out and finding you the answers if they think of themselves as a referee.
No.
That's
the wrong metaphor. Yeah. Definitely the wrong metaphor.
I've got everything off my list pretty much except for the droid business, but we can get back to that.
Well, here's something I wanted to report to you, which is partly a success of our show. Programmers and people with a technical background are starting to inquire about Studio 20, my new graduate program.
Well, congratulations. That's great. You like that, right?
I want that, yeah. It's absolutely essential to the program's success, as well as people who are part of the geek culture, the computer science discipline at NYU are starting to ask, like, what is this thing and how can I be involved, even if they aren't necessarily enrolled in the Studio 20. So this is potentially very important because it allows us to bring editorial people and technologists together in some of our projects. So part of it is a result of the success of this show, but part of it is my collaboration with you, and part of it is that I think with this idea of a studio for building the new system of news, we've perhaps tapped into people's imaginations a little bit. So I just wanted to report that. It's only the start of something. It's only a little boomlet of interest, but it's significant to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, the intersections are always important. Things don't evolve on their own. They evolve relative to other things. And you probably could put the news together with almost anything, as you could put technology together with anything, because they are both pretty pervasive forces. I mean, they're both inexorable. We always want to know what's new. And that's true both of news and technology, right? I mean, you know, well, technology is about what's new, right? I mean, in terms of capabilities, it may be actually interesting to try to figure that out, you know. Right?
And hunger for news is a very human thing. It's not a property of a specialized class.
No, it's built into our genes, you know. It's like, at our breakfast table, and you know, when I was growing up in New York, the phrase was, you know, two things. What's going on with the Mets, and what's going on with the weather?
Right.
Those are the two things, you know. And I think the Mets mean, you know, how is our clan doing, you know? That goes back to caveman days. And the weather, for obvious reasons, we aren't going to eat if the weather doesn't cooperate. And if there's going to be a hailstorm today, we better get the crops in today. You know, all those things are, you know, genetic, DNA, survival of the fittest sort of thing.
And there's traffic, which is what's going on with our systems.
Traffic. But we were public transit guys in our family, so traffic wasn't so important. In New York, you know, do you even own a car, Jay?
I do.
You do? There's a lot of people living in New York.
Right.
Anyway, we got no seconds left. So,
David, it's been a pleasure.
I think we really kicked ass today. So,
bye, everyone.
Bye.